I don't know, you know, I don't know what the right way to teach.
I don't know if there is a right way to teach classes like this these days, but I think sooner or later you do have to kind of put the time in. You just can't learn this stuff sort of by osmosis. You can't learn this stuff without struggling through homework problems and things like that. But I also worry because I hear all these stories from students about how they spend, you know, pulling all-nighters and things like that. And certainly every time in this class when I give an assignment, like an extra credit assignment, a lot of the solutions come to me at 3, 4 in the morning, which worries me. I mean, I sort of appreciate it that you're working that hard to get it done, but I don't quite understand why it seems like students have much more time management challenges these days than when I was a student. I don't know if that's because you're all playing video games during the day. Or
I think technology gives us more work to do.
Well, that's one of my concerns. Is I hear you when you tell me things like, I spent so many hours on this lab report and it was kind of all busy work and things like that. And certainly in this course, I try to limit the amount of busy work.
Yeah. I know the honor code made it harder, too. A lot of the younger people are actually afraid to get in groups and help people and give advice. So, a lot of the classes where you have people that are like 20, you'll actually all have to do the work on your own because those people are afraid to answer any questions.
I'll say, I've
straight up asked people, like, hey, I'm having trouble, my code's not working, and they won't even come up and look, and then I'll waste an hour and it'll be because I left brackets off.
Yeah.
Or if they'd have just got up and looked, they'd have probably noticed it in a second because they didn't write it.
Well, what I like about this class is I don't have to worry about honor code too much because nobody knows how to work most of the problems. So I encourage you to work together because, you know, it's tough. But I do think group study is very important in engineering.
Well, when you work together in real life, you're going to work with more engineers. You're not going to be doing it by yourself.
So, if you have thoughts on, you know, on ways you like courses to be presented, I'd be very interested in hearing them. Certainly, one of the things that has been observed over the past 10 years is that the introduction of PowerPoint hasn't solved all the world's problems when it comes to teaching. And, you know, I think when people got excited about PowerPoint about 10 years ago, there was a feeling that this was going to revolutionize the classroom.
It definitely makes things easier if you don't copy down notes exactly, or if you don't have time to copy notes, you do better focusing on what's being said, but you can go back and you have the notes.
So that's one of the issues we've been debating a lot about, because I'm one of the few who uses PowerPoint notes this extensively with the group I work with and with the faculty. And I noticed that some people take notes, but most people in this class don't take notes. And the argument is, one argument, when I tell my colleagues, well, I'm putting audio online and PowerPoint online, they say, oh, and that means your students aren't going to take notes. And I don't know that that's good. I think note-taking is important. But a lot of people don't do PowerPoint because they argue that it means students won't take notes in class and therefore will not learn the material as well.
If I'm not taking notes, I'm paying better attention to class.
I'm taking notes.
Therefore, the score should be higher on exams.
No matter what we say, you're going to say that, though.
I hear that. Well, ultimately, it is about that, right? I mean, it is at some point a question of.
Well, everything's relative. Higher compared to what?
Well, I actually have a lot of data. Speed of light. I taught this class for a number of years. And I think that in reality, what happens is education just evolves. So areas where, you know, I try to look at it in a positive sense, that when I look at students today, you know a lot more, you have a lot more skills and you're exposed to a lot more technologies than when I was a student. So maybe I was better at doing integrals, but you're certainly better at programming computers and things like that. So it's something the field evolves, but at the same time, we all, as citizens in the U.S., have to be worried about whether our technology base is sort of evolving to something better or evolving to something worse. Certainly global competition is much stiffer today. So students need to be better engineers now than they were 20 years ago.
I think other countries have a completely different outlook on it too, because if you look at a country like China, they have to have a different viewpoint on engineering because most of their politicians are engineers. So, I mean, just for that country to be led by their technology, where ours is led by whoever can be the biggest dicks.
Well, so we were having that was actually the discussion that we were having through email just before class to kind of someone was saying, it looks like I was in deep thought. I was actually thinking about, we're into this whole issue about fun, about is one of the reasons that students don't, quote unquote, study as hard today. Don't, you don't have to debate that, but just the fact that you have. I don't want to accuse you of that so much as just, certainly you have many more distractions today than we have.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's supposed to be a good thing. You say, well, the internet. I mean, I'm amazed what I can do from the internet now that I could not even think about doing before. And so these things have its pros and cons, but one of my observations is that lifestyle in the U.S. is probably our most valuable export. And when you look at these up-and-coming countries, because I was in Japan when Japan was up-and-coming, and everybody talked about the Japanese students being the super race and how they're great students. Well, the problem is once they become affluent to a certain level, they start to adopt all the tendencies of kind of the Western lifestyle. And before you know it, their kids don't want to go to high school and study hard just like our kids don't. And when I was in Japan, the number of the parents I dealt with used to complain about their kids. Oh, they don't want to learn this, they don't want to learn that. What's the matter with them? And I just kind of smile because I know what's the matter with them. They're seeing that they're increasingly getting influenced by Western culture. So I think the real question for engineering students is, what motivates you? In a class like this, you have to be really motivated to learn this kind of material. And in general, when you're faced with abstract mathematical stuff, you have to be really motivated. My daughter, who's in college now, thought she wanted to go into math when she went into college, and I was kind of laughing at that. And sure enough, when she got into college, she's at the University of Chicago, which has a very strong theoretical math program. She didn't like the theoretical math, and she doesn't want to go into the math now. And I kind of thought that was interesting because she was really good in math, but certainly going into theoretical math, just, you know, that's like a calling. It's not something that you do because it's fun. So, you know, I think the question is what motivates you to kind of learn material like this. But material like this is really important if you want to contribute to the highest levels of engineering.
I think the problem with that, though, is one, it's antiquated the way it's taught, and two, it's like the opposite of fun. They put so much on you that the enjoyment you had for it in grade school and high school is just gone. They actually irritate you until you hate something that you did like.
Well, I mean, it's not even so much that. I think, like, yeah, I mean, time's a factor, obviously, and there are a lot of distractions and stuff, but in our curriculum, we end up with a semester. Like, it's semesters instead of quarters, right? So we're going to be in at least 12 hours, probably more, doing, like, tons of coursework for all these random classes. And it's like, as soon as you have time to really sit down and focus on something, you have to leave it immediately and focus on something else. So you're constantly just running around between all these classes and getting, like, this totally fragmented, like, separated idea of what's going on. And
I was saying before class that I think I'm ready for a quarterly system.
Yeah.
Like, I just think it would almost be better.
I don't know, I took quarters, and there are things that's good about it, but I felt like I welcome going to semesters, because quarters is a lot of work.
How does quarters work?
What's quarters?
How do they work?
So my daughter's actually on quarters. University of Chicago is one of the few schools that's on quarters. And your first quarter typically runs from like middle to late September to fairly early in December. And then you have this nice kind of long Christmas break. Then you have a quarter from January to March, and then from March to June. Now, one of the advantages of quarters used to be that you could get a full term in the summer, so over four quarters, you know, in the summer you could get a regular course. But of course, schools are very bottom line driven today, so they didn't take advantage of that. Instead, they try to get two quarters in the summer, which is like one and a half semesters or one and a third semester. So that doesn't quite work. But some people like quarters because the courses go by very quickly. You get a bad professor, bad class, it's like over in a meeting. But some people don't like it because you walk into class and it's like, okay, we have a midterm in 2 weeks. And, you know, it's, it goes by pretty fast.
Yeah, that's true. Ideally, you wouldn't take as many classes per quarter as you would per semester.
Yeah, I took four classes when I was in quarters. It was pretty standard. One lab. One math class. Well, yeah, math, physics, social sciences.
As a Democrat? So you took as many classes, not less?
I took four classes. Typically, you'll take four classes in quarters.
For the first time.
And one of them, if you're a science student, one of them will be a lab. One of them will be a math class, maybe with a recitation section or something. And then your two, what I thought easy classes, your humanities and social science.
But yeah, I would say the thing that frustrates me the most about engineering education is kind of like what Zach was saying. It's just that it seems like we can't just focus on one thing, like we're kind of all over the place.
Yeah. Just skimming the top.
So some schools are thinking about dealing with that by local. In fact, there's some high school programs built around that concept that you take one class for 2 weeks and that's the whole year of the class. And then you go to your next class. Now, I think classes like this require time for things to set in, sink in, so I don't like when students take this class in the summer because it just goes by too fast.
They manage to retire and then after a certain point.
What do you mean?
But I do think that we could do a better job of coordinating the curriculum across the board, and that's always a tough subject because faculty don't like to be told how to teach. But I'm used to working in teams, so I don't have a problem synchronizing my work with someone else's because that's what we do in real life anyway. But
how much is the expectations of an engineering student, or like I guess the workload? How much has it changed since you were in school?
Well, that's what I don't understand. Right. So when I was in school, I think what's actually happened is students have more commitments outside of school, like work. So when I was in school, we were told there was a sort of 1 hour in class, 3 hours outside of class. So if you were taking 10 hours a week in class, if you're taking, 10 hours a week in class, you're talking about 40 hours a week of schoolwork.
See, people say that and, it's a joke. Yeah. Seriously, when people say, oh, you're supposed to, spend 3 hours for every hour out of class, but we know that's totally impractical. What's the attitude towards that now? Was that actually
I think in this class I do a pretty good job of that. But the problem in this class is when you get stuck on homework problems, what do?
You have to ask somebody how to do it.
Right, if there's nobody around,
what do you do?
Then you get perhaps stuck in that rut where you're spending too much time on a problem. So that's one reason I like the recitation section. It gives you a chance to group problem solve. We used to have groups meeting in the building regularly, and when I was in the building more, I used to actually stop in on them, in the evening, you'd see groups meeting upstairs, up on the fourth floor. But one of the reasons I don't ask you to turn in homework is because if I did, the amount of time you'd be spending on this class would be much greater, not so much because you're learning more, but just your all that angst about trying to get the homework problems done and all that.
Yeah, the problem with getting a certain amount of problems done in a certain time and stuff like that.
You have no idea how to do it. Advance.
So anyway, but yeah, if you have more thoughts on that, go ahead and email me or we can talk offline. I'm always interested in learning about the problems you guys face. So what I want to do now over the next couple lectures is to tie together everything we've done by presenting a technique for linear systems analysis that actually unifies most of what we've learned. And it's called state variables or state equations, and it's a technique that's really fundamental to the way a lot of computers actually simulate and solve systems and the way we analyze systems in general, because it turns out we can collapse everything into this single representation. So let's, and as I mentioned at the beginning of class, the exam on Wednesday will not cover this material. So the exam will be up through, I think it's chapter 10 in the book, because I think this is chapter 11.
But, 7 through 10?
So yeah, whatever the left off, wherever, so. And you won't have to worry about this until the final. So thus far we have dealt primarily with input-output characteristics of linear systems. We've talked State variable or state space representations describe the internal state of the system. And that's interesting to us for a number of reasons. State variables represent a way to describe all linear systems in terms of a common set of equations involving matrix algebra. So what we'll end up with today is a set of equations that describes all linear systems, whether they're circuits, whether they're physical systems, whatever. Many familiar properties such as stability can be derived from this common representation. It forms the basis for the theoretical analysis of linear systems. Though it might not seem this way, most of what you learn about circuit analysis can be generalized into a general approach for solving, for dealing with linear systems, and there's a lot of the particular circuit analysis techniques you learn are consequences of some basic theorems in mathematics, graph theory and other things like that, though we don't introduce you to them that way. State variables are used extensively in a wide range of engineering problems, particularly mechanical engineering and the foundation of control theory. So if you go into the control theories class, you will see more of this. State variables often represent internal elements of the system, such as voltage across capacitors and currents across inductors. They account for what we call observable elements of the circuit, such as voltages, and they also account for the initial conditions of the circuit, such as energy stored in capacitors. This is critical to computing the overall response of the system. So state variables essentially capture what we call the memory of the system. And when we look at circuits in particular, state variables will correspond to things like voltages across capacitors or currents flowing through inductors. Now, one of the really neat things about this representation is matrix transformations can be used to convert from one state variable representation to another. So the initial choice of variables is not critical. So this is really neat because you can take a circuit and you can transform it with matrices into another circuit that gives you the same response, the same behavior. You could not tell the difference between the two unless you look at the way the heat's dissipated or something. And therefore, you can actually introduce algorithms that minimize the number of components in the circuit. So if you've ever wondered how people find these minimal representations of circuits, that can actually be done automatically by computer. And that's used when techniques like that are used when you're doing a lot of computer-aided design of circuits today. And then once you make everything into matrices, of course, we can use tools like MATLAB or SPICE to actually analyze the circuit. So that's inside the computer. They use this level of abstraction on the circuit. So we'll sort of go through the definition and of these things, and then we'll end the lecture by applying them to an actual circuit so you can see how they work. So let's define the state of a system by an n-element column vector. Oh, and by the way, did I mention we have to use matrix algebra? So that's a little bit tough for you guys, but hang in there, not too bad. So let us define the state of a system by an n-element column vector, x of t. So x of t is a vector which is going to have these variables x1 of t, x2 through xn associated with it. We can also write that as x1 through xn transpose. We can write either as a column vector or row vector transpose. The x's could be anything, voltages, currents, you don't really care about them at this point. Note that in this development, v of t will be the input, and y of t will be the output, and x of t is used for the state variables. So that's a little bit different notation, but it doesn't really make that much of a difference. So any system can be modeled by the following state equations. The derivative of this vector, x, is equal to a matrix A times x plus a matrix VB times V. The output y of t is equal to c times x of t. This should be a vector. And plus d times v of t. So x is this n by 1 column vector. A is an n by n matrix. B is an n by p matrix. Y is a q by 1 matrix. C is a q by n matrix. And D is a q by p matrix. P is the number of inputs. So another interesting thing about this representation is we can handle multiple inputs. Now, thus far, we've talked mostly about circuits or systems that have a single input and a single output. But of course, there are a lot of systems in the real world that have multiple inputs and multiple outputs. Your stereo is one of them. You have some kind of recording, a CD or whatever, that might have two signals on it. And those can be demultiplexed and transformed into surround sound, which is five signals. So you have two inputs and five outputs. So a lot of systems in the real world actually have multiple inputs and outputs. But again, we can deal with all these systems from the same formulation. So V of T is going to be a vector that represents the number of inputs, and therefore this matrix B has to have a dimension which is N, the number of variables, by P, the number of inputs. And then similarly, B is going to be Q, where Q is the dimension of the number of outputs, and P is the dimension of the number of inputs. So we'll work through an example where we'll actually set up a circuit and we'll show what these A, B, C's, and D's are. But you may have heard the term A, B, C, D parameters, and that's another place where these come from, if you've talked about two-port networks. And when we talk about a circuit, all of the properties of that circuit are going to be contained in these matrices. And we'll show you how to get those representations. But once you've done that, then you don't really care whether it was a circuit or some other kind of system. It's all about the properties of these matrices.
Is that the derivative of x is equal to ax,
yes,
plus bb?
And that's a derivative of x is equal to x, proportional to x. And that's another interesting thing. If I have a nth order differential equation, let's say I have a differential equation which is of order 5, I can actually write that as 5 first order differential equations. And that's actually the technique that we use here. So even though we only have a single derivative, we have n of those derivatives. So n is essentially going to be the order of the system. So this single model can handle single output, single input, single output systems, or multiple inputs and multiple outputs. These equations can be implemented using a signal flow graph. And so here we have the input u. And we have B times V, and we add to that A times X, and we get the derivative of X. So we have this differentiator here. The derivative of X is here. The integral of X is here. And then we can write this equation. And then we have this X times C gives us the output, plus D times V. So this block diagram, and I use 1 over S here just because we're going to, in a minute, we'll be using the Laplace domain. I think next lecture we'll use Laplace transforms to solve this. But this, it's interesting too, that this network describes all linear systems. Any linear system you study throughout your education thus far can be implemented with this network. So you might wonder, well, why did you waste the last 3 years teaching you all these different things? Because from an input-output point of view, this network will produce the same behavior. All that you need to do is figure out what these matrices should be. So let's make this a little more concrete. Let's take a look at this from a differential equation point of view. So here we have a continuous time second order differential equation. The second derivative of y plus a1 times the first derivative of y is equal to a0 times y plus b0 times v of t, where v is the input. Now, what could that differential equation represent? What systems or circuits have we looked at this semester that could be modeled by that differential equation? The RLC circuit was a second order differential equation. And that's one example. It could be, we talked, what is the mess and spring type things? What is the impulse response? What are the types of responses you will see from that circuit if V of T is an impulse function?
You see critically damped, underdamped, and overdamped.
Right. You'll see the three basic types of behavior that we see for second order system. So a second order differential equation is going to require two state variables, since we have, the order of the number of state variables is essentially equal to the order of the highest derivative. So we're going to let, for this equation, we're going to let the first state variable be y of t, and the second state variable be the derivative of y of t. So we can rewrite this differential equation as the first derivative, the derivative of y of t is equal to, I'm sorry, the derivative of, so if we look at that equation, we have the second derivative, y of t, is equal to v0 times v of t minus a1 y dot of t minus a2 y of t. So we can write that that equation as y double dot of t is equal to minus a0 y of t minus a1 y dot of t plus v0 times v of t. So if we let for if we let x2 be y dot of t, then x2 dot of t is y double dot of t. So we can substitute for this, we can write x2 dot is equal to, now for this y of t, this can be written as a0 x1 of t if we let x1 of t be equal to y of t. And then for this a1 y dot of t, we can write x2 of t. So we can write this equation. So this equation is written here. And then we also have the auxiliary equation that x1 dot of t is equal to x2, and y of t is the output is equal to x1. So those three equations are just a way to rewrite that first equation using our state variables. And if we do that now, we can write this set of equations. We can write these two as one matrix equation and this as a very simple matrix equation. So we can write x1 dot, x2 dot, this represents x dot, is equal to, we have 0 times x1 plus 1 times x2, and then we have plus 0 times v of t. So we have x1 dot is equal to 1 times x2. That's just describing this equation. Then for this equation, we have minus a0 x1 minus a1 x2 plus v0 times v of t. So this equation here represents this. And then this equation we can write in a simple form as a vector 1, 0 times x1, x2. So this is just y is equal to 1 times x1 plus 0 times x2. So these two matrix equations represent these three equations. Okay, does everyone follow that?
I follow the matrix representation of the equations, but where, how did you get the equations that you put into matrix form? Like,
right. Okay. So the step from the first equation to these. Yeah. Go through that again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So there's a little bit of art to that, but I'll show you how we do this for a circuit in a moment. But for the moment, let's just assume that second line is some form of divine inspiration.
Okay.
Okay. So if we let x2 of t be equal to y dot of t. And, you know, I just happened to be brilliant and figured that's what I should do. Then x2 dot of t is equal to y double dot. So then the left-hand side of that first equation becomes x2 dot.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we have minus a zero times y of t. Well, y of t will define x1 to be y of t. Again, divine inspiration. Okay. So then I get minus a zero x1 minus a1 x2 plus b zero. Now, how you have the brilliance to do this, there's a couple of interesting points about that. One is, it turns out it doesn't really matter what you choose, because we always can do a matrix transformation to get them to the right state variables. But you have to choose them to be linearly independent of one another. And that typically for a circuit means we're going to look at both capacitors and inductors. And I'll show you that in a moment. Okay, what we've done here is we've shown you how to take a second-order differential equation and represent it in its matrix form. And this approach can be extended to a general nth-order differential equation. And it turns out that an algorithm for doing that is to simply assign the state variables to be the derivatives of the output. But the book goes into that in a little more detail. We won't go into that in much detail in this class. So the resulting state equations, for the general case, and this is actually interesting because we now understand that we can describe any circuit in terms of a general nth order differential equation, right? We've done that now a few times this semester. We took an RC circuit, an RLC circuit. I gave you even a more complex circuit. And if I give you a circuit what kind of differential equation is it going to take to describe this circuit?
Second order.
Third order.
Why?
The three reactive components.
Exactly. So if you've ever wondered where that comes from, that nice little insight, it comes from this. So if you actually write the differential equations out for the circuit, you'll get a third order differential equation. And that's why, not surprisingly, our state variables are going to be related to these reactive components. So if we have a general differential equation, and we don't at this point really care where that came from, it could have been a circuit, it could have been a system, we can actually use this technique of assigning the state variables to derivatives to take that general first order differential equation and write it in this form. So if we define x1 to be x2, take the derivative of x2 to be x3, and so forth, and then take y, the output, to be x1, we can take an nth order differential equation and write it in terms of these four parameters. Now, again, you know, think about that. All circuits that you've dealt with can be written this way. How easy can that be? Come on, right? Now, it didn't seem like that when you were learning all these little circuit analysis tricks, but that describes all circuits you've dealt with. Think how easy that makes circuit analysis. Exactly. That's why, if you've ever wondered what these circuits programs are doing, they're basically building the circuit into a description like this. And circuit analysis then essentially just becomes a problem in topology. Now, let's look at a slightly more complex case where we have, in addition to derivatives of the output, we have derivatives of the input. For this equation, we're going to have a slightly more complicated expression for the output equation. And this is another really interesting thing. You'll notice that no matter what I added here for the input, This A matrix, which describes the derivative of the state variables with respect to the state variables, this matrix stayed the same. Why? Why is that not surprising? When you think about the behavior of this system, what have we learned about the difference between these terms and these terms in terms of the influence they have on, for example, the Laplace transform, the transfer function?
Is it because the A matrix is just describes the system and the B matrix describes the input?
Okay. And these things are going to show up in what, where on the transfer function?
Those are the denominator?
The denominator, which are the poles, right?
Right.
Which are going to influence things like stability.
Okay.
These things are going to show up where in the...
The numerator.
The zeros, which we know does not influence stability. So the impulse response, if you will, the response of the system due to the poles is characterized in this A matrix. And the response to the inputs is characterized in this equation which relates the output to the input. So we also begin to see now that the how the poles influence the system and how the zeros influence the system. We've essentially decoupled those.
Can you tell from an A matrix whether it's stable or not?
Absolutely. So instead of worrying about all these fancy little Ruth Hurwitz algorithms and all these things, all you have to do is throw this into an eigenvalue analysis. Why do we teach you eigenvalues? Because it turns out the eigenvalues of this A matrix tell you everything you need to know about the response of the circuit.
Is it just negative eigenvalues, or is does that like what?
Those are essentially the poles of the system, the resonant frequencies of the system.
Yeah, but aren't, I mean, the eigenvalues are the stable spots in the system, right?
Like, well, the eigenvalues are going to translate to e to the alpha t type terms in the output.
So negative eigenvalues implies stability?
Right, that kind of thing. And the properties of the circuit then can be looked at in terms of the stability properties of this matrix. So all your circuit analysis essentially becomes a consequence of matrix properties. The next class we'll actually solve these equations using Laplace transforms, and we'll generate the complete solution for all circuits in one equation.
So how do you deal with like nonlinear components, like diodes and transistors?
Very good question. So
make them linear.
That's an excellent question. That's an excellent question.
You beat them into submission.
No. So is this a set of linear? Under what conditions is this equation linear? Now I realize it's going to stretch your mathematical abilities a little bit, but just go with your intuition. Is this a linear or nonlinear equation? Under what conditions is this a linear set of equations?
The x of t is a linear equation, and the v of t is a linear equation. Or am I just thinking way too small?
If these are constants,
then
this
it's
is
always
a linear equation, right? If there were terms x squared, x cubed, it would be nonlinear. So we actually can use this analysis for nonlinear systems, but instead of having a constant times x here, we're going to have some function of x. So, for example, if you want to analyze a phase-lock loop, you can write a set of equations like this that describe a phase-lock loop, but it's not going to be a simple matrix of constant coefficients times a vector. There'll be a functional form here, f of x, that behavior.
So the entries in your A matrix would be functions as opposed to scalars?
They could potentially be functions, right. And so they don't really have that decomposition. There's a functional relationship. So there are ways we deal with that. Sometimes we'll have a power series of x. We'll take like a second or third order approximation and only keep the two or three highest terms. Now, what about transistors? That's a really good question. So when you're pumping things through SPICE with transistors and stuff, what's that tool actually doing internally?
Using linear approximations?
Using linear approximations. And this is why when you push the edges of those models, you don't get accurate results with SPICE. Because those are linearized models.
Like when I get 2,000 kV out of my amplifier because I've messed up the feedback.
Right, or when if you say at 28 gigahertz, you should be getting the same gain that you get at 1 kilohertz. Now, the SPICE models, and I'm not an expert on what they're doing these days, but they've gotten pretty accurate, and a lot of the companies that do state-of-the-art design have refined their models to help them deal with particular aspects of their design. But generally speaking, when those computer tools produce these solutions, they're using linearized models. Yeah.
Was there a problem with systems like that, like computer programs when they first started? I seem to, you hear a lot of people, older people on the internet, bitch about how like the software, the spy software lies to you.
That's just generally the first thing that happens is you're using the model in an operating range that it wasn't designed for. So high power versus low power or high frequency versus normal frequency. Dr. Wynn's actually done a lot of work on this, and he can tell you all sorts of really interesting things about the deficiencies of the SPICE models. Because the problem is, if you make every transistor a true nonlinear model, you can't really get good closed form solutions for your circuits. You'd have to use nonlinear equation solvers, and you'd have all sorts of numerical problems with those tools.
Did you ever actually construct it after you built it that way? Because when it parts, not even being tolerant for that.
Well, they do have, I guess with most of these tools, they do have pretty highly tuned models for specific parts. Right, so you can, with a lot of these tools, you can actually put a specific component into your design that will, and the model for that component will be very much tuned to the nuances of that particular component.
I guess I mean kind of like the opposite, resistors and capacitors are maybe all between 5 and 10%.
Right.
And there's a lot of variance between transistors. I know with MOSFETs, a lot of companies had to order them and match pairs because there's so
exactly.
Much variance.
Right. Right. And with precision cut resistors and integrated circuits and things, there's been a lot of evolution of this over the years. But you would not really replace a transistor with its equivalent circuit, but it's important to understand with those tools there are limits to the amount of precision you're getting out of these solutions when you're analyzing active circuits. So that's why a lot of circuits have adjustments built into them, so as you manufacture them on the manufacturing line, you can tune them to offset all the tolerances and things. And designing circuits for manufacturability is something we don't teach a lot of here, but that's a really critical skill you're going to learn when you get out in the real world if you do that kind of thing. Because you want to use cheap components, you want to use as inexpensive components as possible, which usually means you need to have some ability to tune the circuit if it's a circuit that requires that kind of behavior. And in general, this is why everyone goes digital, because it's so much easier to produce, to control your quality and reliability when you produce digital circuits.
Thanks to the software.
Sort of.
You can't.
But then you remember that ultimately, when you're doing all this stuff in software, it's ultimately analog circuits at the bottom that's creating the answers. So
you can't reflash the firmware.
You've all seen these, some of the Intel chips have come out and people find out that in like the 57th digit they're off by some amount because of something in the circuit, and those are very real problems.
Nowadays they do fix that in the microcode though.
Oh, they do. It's crazy
how that works.
Well, I'll have to say a little bit about this. So years ago in the early 90s when I was at Texas Instruments and they were producing Spark chips and they were having trouble with yields, they actually iterated between the physical layout of the chip and the microcode so that they could produce a higher yield of chips because they were working on such the edges of of tolerance of all the traces and things. So they actually rerouted certain operations so that they would be farther apart from each other on the chip so that you wouldn't have as much crosstalk. So you had software people working, hardware people working, and to my amazement, they got the yields up by, you know, orders of magnitude doing this. I mean, the people really good at this kind of thing. And I never saw that before. That I never, you wouldn't think you could, by reordering the way the particular gates that are used for particular instructions, that you could actually improve the yield of your chips on the production line.
That's crazy.
So yeah, then when you're working on the edge of these designs, you do all sorts of crazy things like that. So, so we can actually, from that previous example, we can go back and we can produce through, you know, you can sort of work backwards and actually get back the original equation. So a general linear time invariant system that has both poles and zeros can be implemented this way. That's all linear time invariant systems. And it's interesting, you look at this and you say, well, gee, most of the matrix is empty. That seems like waste. It seems like you could do, put stuff in there and make maybe the system do more. Because look at how sparse this matrix is for all linear time invariant differential equations.
Sparse matrices are so much better than dense matrices. Like,
yeah, come on, don't you feel like your whole education, you know, 3 years of this stuff, and here it is.
Like there should be more.
Every circuit you've ever solved is this simple.
That's why I've always hated SPICE. That's what it is. SPICE is the devil.
Okay, so let's quickly go through a couple examples. So we'll start with a first order differential equation on the left, and then we'll go to our favorite RLC circuit on the right. So the circuit on the left, we've produced this differential equation to describe it. dy dt plus 1 over RC, y of t is equal to 1 over RC times v of t. We did that just by running a voltage loop. And so for this equation, this is a pretty simple one. We're going to let the matrix A be equal to, using our, so we have this template. I'll show you how easy this is. All we have to do, so that's a first order differential equation. So all we have to do is reduce this matrix to a 1x1 matrix and reduce these to similarly reduce the dimension. So in this case, when this is a 1x1 matrix, all we're going to be left with is this term. So for this circuit, the A matrix is going to reduce to minus A0, and minus A0 in this case is going to be minus 1 over RC. Which comes from this term here. B is going to be just B0, which comes from this 1 over RC here. C is 1 and D is 0. So this circuit can be represented as X1 dot is equal to minus 1 over RC times X1 plus 1 over RC times B of T. And Y of T is just equal to 1 times X1 of T. And the only state variable that we need, X of T, is going to be equal to Y of T. So this is the state variable representation for this circuit. Now for the second order circuit, we've written a second order differential equation that represents this circuit. Now to transform this to state variables, we can use the technique that we described previously. We are going to have an A matrix which has A0 and A1 here, a B matrix which just has B0 here, the C matrix will still be 1 and 0, and the D matrix will be 0. So for in this case, the A0 is going to be associated with Y of T, and A1 is going to be associated with this R over L. And then B will be similar here, just 1 over LC times B. So these are the four matrices for this circuit, which gives us this set of state variable equations. And in general, what you're going to do when you assign state variables is you're going to want to look at, for the circuit, you're going to look at currents through inductors and voltages across capacitors. But even if you chose the voltage across the inductor and the current through the capacitor, once you got the representation, I could transform it into this representation just using a matrix transformation. And that transformation actually is found using eigenvalues and eigenvectors, but we won't really talk about that this semester. So what we've done today, we've introduced the concept of a state variable, and we've shown you how to take nth order differential equations and write them as these state equations. We demonstrated these techniques for first order and second order circuit. And all passive circuits, all RLC circuits, for example, can be implemented in this way. Now, next class, what we'll do is we're going ahead and solve these equations. And since they involve derivatives, we'll go ahead and make use of our Laplace transforms, and we'll actually show that we can compute a general solution to these equations involving some matrix manipulations. And then you'll have a completely linear algebra-based technique for handling all differential equations. And that's really powerful, and it's used extensively throughout engineering. Okay, I will see you on Friday. Cool.